Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Today, I will give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by one of my inspirations, founder of the Sexual Violence Prevention Association, Omni Miranda Martone. Welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Absolutely. I think, the work that you do is so deeply powerful and so deeply inspiring because, especially right now, whenever we think about sexual and gender-based violence, I automatically think of the Jeffrey Epstein files, like right off the top of my head. It goes further back than that, and it goes way deeper than that. Obviously, that is what is in the headlines right now, which is very valid, obviously. But I am deeply excited to learn about your journey, being the CEO and founder of the Sexual Violence Prevention Association, what led you into doing that, and as a survivor who's disabled, queer, non-binary yourself, you bring a lot of intersectional identities into this work and understanding the true complexity, but also that healing aspect, because healing is not linear, it's complex. This issue is not linear. It's complex because there's a lot that surrounds it and a lot that goes into that. So I am excited to learn about your journey. Walk us through, beginning your career in sexual violence, working with the local nonprofits and the rape crisis centers that you've worked with, and just walk us through your journey, my friend. I'm so excited to have you.
Yeah, no, well, I'm so excited to be here. I love all the work that y'all do, so I am just so excited. We've been working together on social media posts and stuff for a while, but I'm really glad that through the podcast that spurred us to actually meet and chat face to face and stuff, which is I just think so important in this work. So really excited to be here. So I'm Omni Miranda Marteau. My pronouns are they and they, and I'm the founder and CEO of the Sexual Violence Prevention Association. But first and foremost, I am a survivor, right? I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse and rape, and I'm not going to go into too many details on that, so it's not too triggering. But all I will say is that it continued for several years as a child, and then I experienced rape as an adult, and then that brought back a lot of memories and a lot of other things. And through that experience, I was like, I really want to work to prevent this, right? I know that what happened to me, especially as a child, could have been prevented, and there's many instances where it could have been intervened and didn't need to go on as long as it did, or could have been prevented entirely. And that was really a very defining moment for me. I was like, I'm going to work to prevent this. That's what I want to do. And so I started in the field. I did not think to start a nonprofit. That was not even on my radar, something to do. Instead, I started working in the field, and I worked for a lot of organizations in the field over a period of years. And I had some great experiences and some not so great experiences. But I worked for RAIN, the Rape Abuse Access National Network. I worked for Every Voice Coalition, an amazing student-led organization fighting sexual violence on college campuses. I worked for the YWCA, which does a lot of great work across the country and internationally. And I worked for a few other orgs all related to that, the Sexual Assault Response Coalition and a few others. And through this work, I, learned quite a lot. One of the biggest things I learned was that most organizations, pretty much all organizations, everybody really, is doing response. They're helping survivors. And I wanted to work to prevent sexual violence before it happened. And instead, what these orgs are doing is providing survivors with support and resources and mental health help and medical advocacy and legal support and advocacy and, really, really important things. Vital, vital, vital. We are need survivor support services. But I wanted to work to prevent things before they happened. And I wasn't seeing that, and that's what I wanted to do. And so I started doing some research, and I started doing some other things, and I kept working in the field, right? I was just like, well, what does prevention look like for sexual violence? Is that something that's possible? And so I started looking into it. And then also during this time with these other orgs, and some of them, these orgs, I had some kind of negative experiences. As somebody who's disabled and queer, I experienced homophobia, experienced transphobia, I experienced some ableism, and a lot of my colleagues and my close friends who I'd made through this work experienced racism and we anti-Semitism. Like, we were just seeing some real issues. A lot of organizations in the sexual violence space have a very warped view of sexual violence as it being an issue that white women experience, right? And that is not the clearest of pictures. That's not super accurate. It is something that white women experience, but it's something that a lot of other populations experience. And so I, given my own identities, do not define sexual violence as only gender-based violence, right? It's kind of like a square and a rectangle thing. Like gender-based violence can be part of sexual violence, but sexual violence can be perpetrated on the axes of any form of oppression. Sexual violence is often perpetrated as a form of homophobia and transphobia, and historically and in present day, it's often perpetrated as a form of racism and xenophobia. And so to view it only as a gender-based issue is to ignore some really vital, like very important root causes. Vital has a positive connotation, and I don't necessarily mean that. I more so mean that it is to view it as something that is foundational. And if you want to break down the foundation that is sexual violence so it stops happening, we can't only address gender-based violence. We need to address all of these issues. And so basically, I was like, well, we need this movement to be led by those who are most impacted. Right, a lot of the organizations I worked for, some of which were really amazing, so I don't want to imply that all of these organizations were having these issues, but some of them were really amazing. Some of them definitely, especially the bigger ones, kind of had these issues. And so I was like, well, if we really want to work on systemic prevention, we need to be led by those who are most impacted. We can't just be led by survivors generally. It needs to be those who are most impacted. This needs to be marginalized survivors. This needs to be people of color, LGBTQ plus people, disabled people, immigrants, people that are, already experiencing other forms of marginalization that have contributed to the issue at hand. And so that was like another realization I had right throughout my like 7 years of working in the field for other orgs. And I started talking with some of my colleagues that had experienced these similar issues that I'd experienced about this. And I was like, well, I want to work to do prevention, right? We're having all these issues. We're not looking at this as a systemic problem, and I want to work to prevent this. And I feel like that's possible. Why are we not seeing it? And so, a lot of my colleagues were very encouraging and said, oh, okay, well, like, what would that look like? There's no orgs doing that. And so then I did a lot of research in prevention, and social movements and public health, interestingly enough. And I looked mostly at the drunk driving, the anti-drunk driving movement, which is one of the most successful social change campaigns that we've had in the past, I would say, 50 years. Basically, in a period of a few decades, drunk driving was more than halved, so more than 50% less only a few decades. And that was achieved by several nonprofits working really hard on prevention, right? Not just response. They were doing prevention. And then I looked at some others. I looked at there's a lot of very successful campaigns to end youth cigarette usage. I will say they were very successful campaigns, but a lot of that progress has now been lost to the vaping industry. But before the vaping industry swooped in and changed the game, they were very successful, right? Youth cigarette usage went down by, I think it was almost 70% in about a 40-year period. That is a crazy reduction, right? And that's not a lot of time. 40 years sounds like a lot of time, but it's not a lot of time. And so then I looked at those. I looked at some of the responses against HIV and AIDS, and how was prevention working, especially community-based prevention. And I looked at a few other, social issues and things like this, and public health campaigns like ending teen pregnancy and things like that. Because I didn't have examples within sexual violence, so it didn't exist. So I was like, well, let's look to other movements, right? Let's look to others who are successful, and let's apply it to sexual violence. And so through this research and this work, and I got my master's during this time as well, and I did my dissertation on this, and this was a very big, lot of research, a lot of like very book heavy, and a lot of interviewing people, and a lot of all of that. I went back to the same colleagues who had like really encouraged me to look into this, and I was like, I think like that this is possible, and I just don't know why nobody is doing it. And one of my friends just so casually said, oh, why don't you just do it? Why don't you just start an organization and do it? And I was like, oh, I'd never thought of that. Like, I still had not ever thought of that. I was like, how do we make these existing orgs do this stuff, right? The stuff that we've now, like, that I've now researched and found out we could do. Systemic change, how do we do that? And now that I know how to do it, why is nobody doing it, right? And then my friend just so casually was like, you should do it. And I was like, okay, well, and I'd love to say I immediately did it, but I didn't. I was like, let me sit on that for a little bit. And I kept working in the field for a little while longer. And then eventually, myself and several of those colleagues, I was like, can you join me as founding board? And I think we should do this. I think that friend is right and that we should, you know, attempt to do this, right? And so that was the start of the SUPA. The entire goal was to, you know, be led by marginalized survivors, be led by those most impacted, and to prevent sexual violence before it happens, and to try to effectively prevent it in a way that we can scale up and within a few decades make a measurable impact in preventing sexual violence at scale. So that's really how, you know, the organization came to be. That's how I kind of entered this work. And then we've, of course, grown a lot as an organization. We've existed for about, I guess, like five or 6 years, like, you know, in total. But I would say, like, you know, with me working full time at the organization, with the organization being like a real full nonprofit and not just kind of us informally doing what we can, I would say has been about 4 years of, like, you know, full time. You know, pedal to the metal. Let's get stuff done. But yeah, that's how we came to be.
I'm so in awe of you, but also the work that you do. I know you, and like you said, I know that that's reciprocated. But whenever I tell you that every time I receive a DM on Instagram and I see it's from SVPA, I get so excited because I know that it's going to be something very deeply impactful, inspiring. So, you know, first of all, just thank you for allowing me to sit down and talk to you because it is a deep honor. I want to kind of pivot a little bit and talk about some of the work that you do because you do these impact reports. And I find it very inspiring to sit down and like read these reports. And I read the 2023 one. I need to sit down and read 2024. And I know there's more reports that are coming out. But walk us through, because since the start of 2021, the SVPA has been dedicated to preventing sexual violence systematically. Now, walk us through what SORVO is, SORVO, and what that entails, because there's a lot that goes into this. So walk us through what
Yeah.
SORVO reports are, walk us through, you know, your research process, what you look for, what you have found. Just walk us through as the CliffsNotes version of what Sorbo is.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much for looking at our impact reports. I honestly love like putting those together every year. I feel like a lot of people dread it. I truly love it to look back on what we did every year. It's like I am like beaming with pride for this organization and all the amazing people that work here. Every single time I do it, I'm like, this is incredible. And it just feels like a dream for me to like be like, wow, like we're really, you know, doing the thing I wanted to do, right? So many years ago, that's so connected to my own identity as a survivor and such. And so Sorvo actually came about, this is very interestingly connected to that very early experience as a survivor. And so I, you know, experienced that sexual violence as an adult brought back a lot of memories of childhood. And also at the same time, right? So I experienced the sexual violence and I know so many other people who experience this who are LGBTQ plus, right? And so I'm sitting there as a queer person being like, oh, it's so common. Like, you know, every single queer person I know has experienced this. And at the same time, we were in Trump's first presidency. He kept calling LGBTQ+ people pedophiles and rapists and all this stuff, right? He always does that. He does that still now. And I was like, that's just the opposite, right? That's not true, right? That's the opposite of the truth. He's calling queer people pedophiles and rapists, but the truth is that a lot of queer people, myself included, are the victims of sexual violence. We're the victims of sexual violence perpetrated by cis people, sometimes homophobic and transphobic driven sexual violence and hate crimes that, you know, and to say, oh, actually it's the other way around is just not accurate. And to then use that fake statement that, oh, well, trans people are pedophiles and rapists, so they're not allowed in bathrooms and they're not allowed in sports and they're not allowed to be teachers. To say those things, I was like, that's crazy. That's a fake statement that you're using as an excuse. And it just was very frustrating. You know, for me, and I'm sure for, of course, many other people. And at the same time, I was reading a book about the history of sexual violence, the use of sexual violence throughout slavery and the Jim Crow era. I'm not necessarily going to read the name of this book, but let me just hold on. It's the Delectable Negro. So I'm not necessarily going to say that, but it is by Vincent Woodard, and it is genuinely a very, very, very important book that I think everybody should read. Very, very important. And it's not only about sexual violence, but sexual violence is very heavily covered. It's a very heavy book that I still think everybody should read. So I read this book, and I was seeing a very similar pattern. White supremacists were committing significant amounts of sexual violence against Black people during enslavement and during Jim Crow. And at the same time, white people were claiming, oh, well, Black people are rapists and pedophiles, and they would do the same to us. They are doing the same to us, and that's why we must continue this oppression, right? We must continue to, have people be in slavery is because they are these people that will commit horrible acts of sexual violence and have committed horrible acts of sexual violence. And I was like, well, that's the same thing. That you're doing the same thing. You flipped it again. They flipped it that back then to excuse their to justify right their oppression. And they're doing it right now to justify oppression against LGBTQ plus people. And I was like, huh. And I kind of, I did some more research into this against LGBTQ plus people broadly, and into its use during Jim Crow, because that's really when the use of sexual violence as an excuse really ramped up, was during the Jim Crow era in the United States, as an excuse to continue oppression against Black people. And so I was just doing this research, and was like, I basically put together a real quick framework. I was like, well, they're reversing the victim and offender, similar to Darvo, for anybody who's familiar. They're reversing the victim and offender in order to justify systemic oppression. And that's where we get SORVO. So systemic oppression, reverse victim and offender. And it is that oftentimes oppressive groups and entities will claim that the group they are looking to oppress commits high rates of sexual violence, when the reality is they're committing a high rate of sexual violence against that oppressed group. And they make that false claim, and they reverse the victim and offender of sexual violence in order to justify their systemic oppression. And this is not new. It was used, of course, during enslavement and during Jim Crow, and it's been used broadly against LGBTQ plus people. But at the time, that's kind of where I stopped. I did some research. I put together these some pillars on, like, this is the pillars of SORVO, right? This is what I felt, were the pillars of what was going on, but I didn't really formalize it too much. And then I'm going to be honest with you, I got busy with work and with other things, and then I got busy starting the SUPA, and I just really didn't touch it. I just kind of was like, oh, well, I put that together and I got other stuff to do, so maybe I'll revisit that someday. And then we started seeing very significant patterns of this exact same thing happening in Palestine. And of course, with Trump and the rise of Trump in the second term here, we were seeing it very commonly used against immigrants and used against trans people again. It was used against immigrants, to be clear, in Trump's first term as well. It's been used against all of these populations. And so I was like, maybe I should revisit this, right? Because people need a word, right? They need the term in order to interrupt what's happening, right? In order to call it out when they see this stuff happening. And so basically, we put together as an organization a full report with four historic case studies about SORVO, just explaining what this framework is, explaining that systemic oppression, basically this group, whatever the group is. So for example, this happened during the Holocaust as well. Like, Nazis committed oppression against Jewish people. And as their power increased, because their oppression was increasing, they were able to better manipulate the narrative, right? They're better able to control the media. They're better able to control what people see and hear, the data that's collected, and everything. And then because they are collecting that media, that data, that narrative, because they control that, they're able to better reverse the victim and offender of sexual violence, right? And then they use this false narrative to justify their oppression, and that increases their power and their control, which means they're better able to manipulate the narrative. And it's a cyclical, it's a cycle. I almost said it's a cyclical cycle. And that reversing a victim and offender, basically, so to continue to use the Nazi regime as an example. The Nazi regime was committing high rates of sexual violence against Jewish people. Acts of sexual violence against Jewish people were frequent and common, right? Because the Nazi regime had control at the individual, institutional, and systemic levels, right? They controlled all of those things. And so the Nazi regime was able to commit high rates of sexual violence. Whereas Jewish people committing sexual violence against people within the Nazi regime was, of course, pretty much non-existent or incredibly rare. And that's because Jewish people did not have control at those upper levels. You know, there might be individual level power and control, like one person being stronger than another, but they didn't have institutional or systemic power and control. And that narrative manipulation really comes from, and this is true, I'm using the Nazi regime as an example, but this is true for all of the cases I've mentioned, right? And so they deny, omit, they erase, and they de-define the sexual violence that Nazis were committing against Jewish people, right? They deny it happened. They omit it from the papers. They omit the data. They erase it. Victims try to speak out and they often would kill them, or they de-define it. They say, well, that's actually not sexual violence. They did that during the Jim Crow era as well, when they literally had laws saying that sexual violence against Black women and girls was fully legal and was not considered sexual violence. And at the same time, any sexual violence committed by any Jewish people against the Nazi regime or anybody who the Nazi regime deemed worthy, right? Any sexual violence that the Jewish people committed was either fully falsified, just didn't exist and was falsified, or was exaggerated if there was one or two cases, or was sensationalized if there was one or two cases. It was in the news and it was very emotionally heart-pulling language, graphic depictions, photos, or it was redefined. Things that weren't considered sexual violence were redefined to be sexual violence. So, for example, we see that with LGBTQ plus people, right? They claim that drag queens reading a book fully clothed as a normal person would, right? Reading a book to a child, that's sexual violence. Well, that's not. That's redefining sexual violence to allow it to allow you to claim that this person is committing sexual violence. And that exaggeration and that sensationalization, like, you know, we see that a lot with immigrants, for example. We saw that with the Lincoln Riley Act. There is, you know, few cases, a very small handful of cases of an immigrant committing sexual violence against a natural born citizen in this country. And those several cases are blasted on the media. That's exactly what the law, right, the policy is named after, while ignoring all of the many, 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 many more cases of sexual violence committed against immigrants. Right, it's making it seem like it's higher in one direction, right? And it's making this false narrative that, you know, this oppressive group is a victim of sexual violence by the oppressed group, and thus is justified in their, you know, very aggressive genocide, oppression, you know, Holocaust, apartheid, right? This was also very, very aggressively used in apartheid South Africa. And so basically our first report, which came out last year, I think it was September of last year, just uses four historic case studies. It looks at apartheid in South Africa. It looks at the Holocaust. It looks at LGBTQ plus people worldwide historically. And then it also looks at Jim Crow era in the United States. And then we did a follow-up report much more recently about the use of SORVO against Palestinians, and how both Israel and the United States are doing the same playbook, the same SORVO playbook, to justify the genocide that's happening in Palestine. And we have two follow-up reports that will be coming up in the next year. The first one's on the present day use of SORVO against trans plus people. And I say trans plus people to be inclusive of intersex people, trans people, and other forms of gender non-conforming individuals. And we also have a follow-up report that'll be a little bit later next year about the use of the present day use of SORVO against immigrants. And our goal with these reports is to allow people to identify what's happening and interrupt it. Because when people look at these sensationalized headlines, right, this narrative manipulation, it's convincing because sexual violence is deeply upsetting and so many people are survivors. So it triggers people's fight or flights, right? And it makes people, you know, upset. And then they are, you know, their anger, their empathy and their anger is being weaponized to control them and control what they believe and control the oppression they're willing to allow and permit. And so our goal by putting out these reports is to allow people to both identify that this is happening, and interrupt it, and to prevent the sexual violence against the oppressed group and prevent the narrative manipulation that's justifying the oppression.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And, you know, part of this podcast and having like a very broad, like, you know, reach, you know, I've been interviewing some people from the UK, interviewing some people from Canada, interviewing people from Australia. And I think it's really unique, kind of like learning from their perspective, like what they see happening in the United States. And one of them actually asked me, she was like, what in the actual hell is going on in the United States? I said, well, first of all, how much time do I have to explain to you what we're seeing? what's happening right now just across the country, and like especially in like some of the deep red states, right? Because look at Alabama. They're getting ready to really lose a lot of people off of food stamps and Medicaid, and even Missouri, and like these crucial services that not only just everyday Americans utilize, but also people who are further marginalized, that are disabled, that are LGBTQ, that are single parents, because we're stuck in this capitalistic hellscape that continues to, drain our pockets, and wages go down and the rent goes up. But also along that line, we're getting really close to the holidays, which we all know that every time the holidays happens, so does sexual assault, so does domestic violence, gun violence, because the holidays can either bring out the best or the worst in people. And if you have a dysfunctional family like mine, well, it's even worse. So what have you heard as far as like feedback to the work that you and SVPA is doing, and what has been that feedback that you've been receiving? Either from survivors or organizations or other other organizers in this space. What are you hearing as far as feedback goes?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I love getting feedback. I like truly one of the things I think that has allowed us as an organization to grow so significantly and do this like very impactful, very innovative work is that we have deep relationships with not just survivors, but with marginalized communities who trust us to address this issue fully, right? And not just be addressing it from, once again, like a white cis straight woman's like point of view, because that's just not what we're here to do, right? That avenue has been explored and is covered by many other orgs, right? We are trying to really address it. So we've heard a lot of things. We've honestly gotten very, very positive reception on pretty much all of our work, specifically Sorvo, just because I was just talking about that. I can talk about how we've gotten several people reaching out to us who are victims of this like state violence, right? So example against like Palestinians, a lot of that sexual violence that's happening is state violence at the hands of the IDF, right? And we're hearing from people who are survivors of this type of violence who have been silenced, right? So the whole point of Sorvo is it silences Palestinian survivors and then it amplifies, these false accusations and all of that. Just saying that, it was very validating to hear somebody talk about this and talk about how not only are they victims and how that's been ignored, but also that their victimhood is a pawn, right? It's being a pawn for politics. And that is just so deeply upsetting, right, to them and the silencing of them and ignoring what's going on. And so that's just something where we've heard from many people that having Sorvo, having the term, right, a term to quickly use to talk about this very common thing that's used to oppress groups has been very helpful. And we've spoken with several actually groups about engaging men in the movement, specifically engaging Black men in the movement, talking about how Sorvo and talking about how false accusations of sexual violence were commonly used and still are commonly used as a form of oppression against Black people. We saw this with Emmett Till as one of the most famous examples, right, where he was accused of sexually harassing a white woman. And that was what that accusation, which was later, the woman admitted it was false. That false accusation was used to justify that lynching, right? And so that is like a small microcosm of what's broadly happening. And acknowledging that that's happening really allows people to engage in the work a lot more. Acknowledging that, this is a form of oppression. Both the sexual violence and the false accusations broadly against a group are forms of oppression that are commonly still used today and commonly used historically. And so that we've gotten a lot of great feedback from. And in general, with a lot of our work, we get a lot of feedback. It's a lot of positive feedback. We don't do anything unless we have not only marginalized survivors in agreement that this is something we should do, but people specifically from the communities most impacted by that work saying, yes, we should do this. This is the right thing to do. And so I feel like that just makes it so like we're never kind of like, oh, don't know if people are gonna like this. Like we already know people are gonna like agree with what we're doing or want to join the fight before we start it. And that's how we really make our decisions for what we're gonna work on as an organization, because unfortunately we don't have the capacity to do everything. And so that's how we kind of decide, okay, this is what we're gonna do. Something I do think is very interesting, and I think I'm just thinking about it because, you know, it's been coming up a lot that I would love to, talk about for hours on end, is this kind of issue of like waiting for a revolution versus working within the system. So we're working a lot on state-sanctioned sexual violence, which is when the state, like the government, either the government itself allows, governmental workers, or the government allows other workers, like hospital workers, let's just say like nurses or doctors, to commit sexual violence as part of their job. And sometimes even legally requires that they commit sexual violence. This is things like stripping cavity searches, where in any other context that would be considered sexual violence, right? It's an invasion of somebody's body, it's an invasion of their privacy, it's invasion of their autonomy and their consent. And that is not considered sexual violence because the state has deemed it not to be sexual violence, but that is sexual violence. And I could talk at length about the work that we're trying to do against strip searching and cavity searches. And there's a lot more. There's also state-sanctioned sexual violence against intersex people, which I could talk about as well. But in general, our work with state-sanctioned sexual violence has been an interesting one because it leads us to advocate for police and prisons, for example, to use alternatives to strip searching, right? So, where we're at right now, when we're considering what to do for legislative advocacy, is do we advocate for laws at the state level that would require all jails and prisons to switch from strip and cavity searches to the TSA machines, those little machines where you put your hands up and it swirls around you, right? Those machines are shown to be a lot more effective at detecting contraband, and they are a lot less invasive as opposed to this very, this basically assault, which is strip and cavity searches, right? The TSA machines are a lot less invasive than a strip or a cavity search. And so do we at a state level require, right, that they switch? And then in doing so, that's probably going to come with funding so that they can purchase those machines because they're very expensive machines. And that isn't really icky place to be in. We are a police abolitionist organization. We are not in favor of the current criminal legal system. We do not feel that it prevents sexual violence. We do not feel that it is a solution. And we actually feel like it causes sexual violence because it increases oppression. And oppression is a form of power and control, often weaponized to commit sexual violence. So we are quite against this system. And in a revolution, we would not have to be fighting against strip and cavity searches in the system because the system wouldn't exist. But right now, the system does exist. And are we legitimizing the system, right, by working at a state level to, affect these strip and cavity searches? But also, as somebody who has unfortunately had some brushes with the criminal legal system during my wild younger years and during my current protesting years, as an individual person, I'm like, well, yeah, I might legitimize this institution, but I don't want to be sexually assaulted every time I'm charged or booked for protesting, right? And neither do other people. So it puts us in a difficult spot. And that's something where we've been talking a lot about as an organization and with the community more broadly, right? The community of both survivors, people who are incarcerated, people who regularly interact with the criminal legal system of, are we legitimizing this system by doing this? But does this also, provide some relief? And like, how much do you work within a system that currently exists to change it versus how much do you try to overthrow said system? Because we're also trying to overthrow that system, right? We don't want that system to exist. It does not address sexual violence and restorative and transformative justice and many other systems and ideas that, many people have come up with, are much better solutions. But those are unfortunately unlikely to happen. And although we'll keep advocating for those in the meantime, do we do this? And so that's actually, I don't know if that's feedback. That's maybe bringing up kind of a different question, but it is something we're thinking about a lot as an organization right now. Is like, we don't want to do nothing because we're just waiting for revolution. So what do we do? And also, how do we support a broader revolution, right? And broader, big, systemic, like full actually like removal of systems and abolition of systems. And so, how do you kind of marry those two things and make sure that you're making change that is effective and that it will last for generations and not just be a short-term band-aid.
Because we all know exactly where those short-term band-aids have led us. Look at the direct inaction of elected officials in the United States, but also along our communities too. And this is why I always say that it doesn't matter how big or how small an election is, It's always just, there's so many things going on. Oh my God, it's so hard to like kind of like pinpoint everything that's kind of happening. And I think there's just literally so much going on. It's hard to keep track of. It's hard to stay focused on, but you do it in such a unique way. And one of the last questions that I have for you, and obviously, feel free to like share anything else that you want to share as well, like anything that's coming up with SVPA that people should be aware of. But how do we as a society recognize the ongoing epidemic of sexual and gender-based violence? And how do we as a society recognize the need to continue having these conversations and continue raising awareness about the things that are going on across the country and also across the world? Because, again, this isn't just here. You also mentioned about Palestine. You mentioned, and also thinking about like Congo and thinking about Sudan and Afghanistan and all of these other places where genocide is active, continuing going on, oppressing marginalized voices. How do we as a society continue pushing forward? Obviously a big thing is obviously the Jeffrey Epstein files, the unredacted Jeffrey Epstein files, which gives us a lot of information, which I don't know if you saw it, but there's a new book by Virginia Guidry that came out, and she talked about one of the former Israel prime ministers in her book. And I found this very interesting to sit back and learn about. And I find it very interesting. We have connected with the family of Virginia, and they'll be coming on a future podcast episode. But Virginia is one of the most vocal and prominent survivors of sex trafficking and prominent survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. And then also, Prince Andrew was also involved in that. A lot of it was very psychological abuse, which she states was the worst part, as stated in her memoir, which is called Nobody's Girl. And it's been released as of midnight yesterday. Virginia passed away, unfortunately, in April 2025. But I think about this, and I think about stories like Virginia, and I think about stories like Jess Michaels and Marina Lacerda. And we're connected to all of them. And I think just sitting back and learning about their experiences and their stories has been one of the most fulfilling experiences for me, because it opens the eyes of so many. And people are really focused on this across the aisle, like both sides of the aisle. They're really focused on the Jeffrey Epstein files, but also accountability is also key. So with that being said, how do we as a society recognize the ongoing epidemic, and how do we fight back from your perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Virginia's book did, as you said, just come out last night. So I, of course, have not yet read it in full, but we are connected with Virginia's family as well. I really do highly recommend reading it. I plan to read it myself as soon as I really can sit down and really take in this information, but definitely do recommend reading it. And we actually are also working on a joint letter by organ like from I think we are at like 35 or 36 organizations have signed on demanding Congress release files. And so we'll, you can look for that. That'll probably be in our social theory.
You actually just cut out that entire part. It went completely silent for a second.
Where did it start cutting out?
It right whenever you started talking about potentially going on social media with the
Yeah, okay. So folks can look on social media and on our website. We should be posting that. It's basically we're going to go live with that letter and deliver it in person to several key members of Congress when ever they come back. if they ever come back. So I mean, stay in tune for that, but they're clearly stalling and purposefully, halting the entire government in, I think, because of the Epstein files, because they don't want to swear in the new representative who's the last vote they need to force the files. But anyways, I do think that the Epstein case and files and all of the related things that come with that is honestly demonstrates part of the problem at hand, right? This is an international case of pedophilia, sex trafficking, massive amounts of sexual violence, that has been not just excused by governments and authorities, but participated in by governments and authorities. And I think that that really brings up the fact that, the existing systems are not here to save us, right? The existing systems of rule and law are not going to protect us from sexual violence. They're not going to protect us from really anything. And that also brings up something that I think is important because you mentioned, this is an epidemic and it's a global epidemic of both gender-based violence and sexual violence. And I completely agree on that. And I want to add that I think an epidemic feels like it's not man-made, but this is entirely man-made. Right? An epidemic is typically, something that just happens in nature, and this is not one of those things, right? Sexual violence is absolutely man-made, and it is not a natural occurrence amongst the human population. It's something that should and can be and should be prevented. And I also think it's important to understand that oftentimes people look at sexual violence as this independent issue. And I understand why. Our whole organization's dedicated to this issue, so clearly we view it as an independent issue, but it also isn't entirely an independent issue. It is inherently every issue, right? Any issue is every issue. I always say that. Like, any issue is every issue. Any issue can be connected in many ways to every other issue, right? Any fight is every fight. But sexual violence specifically is every fight because sexual violence is weaponized against every oppressed population ever, right? It's weaponized against women. That's the one that most people think of when they think of sexual violence, right? Is sexual violence is a form of sexism. It's a result of a sexist society and misogyny, and that is absolutely true. But sexual violence is also a result of homophobia and transphobia. It's also absolutely a result of racism. We saw sexual violence massively in this country throughout the Trail of Tears and throughout Jim Crow and throughout enslavement, of course. We saw this, sexual violence has been so common in internment camps. It's so common in every form of oppression that has ever existed. Sexual violence has also been there. We see sexual violence increase as climate change increases. Sexual violence increases with climate disasters, right? That feels like an issue that should be so different, and yet it is not. Because any issue that has power and control, any issue that has authority, any issue that has systems that are imbalanced with their power and control will result in sexual violence. And they will also be caused by sexual violence. It is not just a result of those existing power imbalances. Sexual violence is a tool to gain and maintain power, control, and oppression. And that might be a hard thing to wrap your brain around. So it's important to understand at the individual level, let's just say, right? This happens a lot with, we'll use the example with women. Women that try to enter the STEM fields experience a lot of sexual harassment from their classmates. They experience sexual violence from their classmates. And that often leads a lot of women to leave STEM fields before they even enter them. They often leave them during college, sophomore year, freshman year sometimes. That is a form of sexual violence, not just being a result of the existing power imbalances and not just being a result of existing sexism and the systems of sexism that have resulted in so few women in the field. That is why that's happening, but also it's a cyclical issue, right? It's also forcing more women not to enter the field. Now we're going to have less women in the field, less women looking out for other women, more inequity, and more sexual violence. And so that's true at that individual institutional level, like I just gave, but that's true at the systemic level as well. Sexual violence was not just used during the Trail of Tears because there was an existing power imbalance between settlers and native people. No, sexual violence was being used as a form of fear, intimidation, power, control, and genocide. It's a form of eugenics to force some populations to have children and other populations not to. So I think what's really important when understanding the epidemic that is sexual violence does not exist in a vacuum. It does not increase in a vacuum. If sexual violence is increasing somewhere, it's because other forms of power, control, and oppression are increasing. So as authoritarianism increases internationally and of course nationally, we are going to see sexual violence increase. Sexual violence is the canary in the coal mine. As sexual violence increases, we know there are broader issues, broader forms of power, control, and oppression that must be addressed. And addressing sexual violence will help to prevent those, and preventing those will help to prevent sexual violence.
And you said a key part is to prevent. And I think that's where a lot of focus is. And I also want to bring awareness to, and like the lack of focus on also the postvention. So how do we recognize after violence happens to ensure that the re-victimization and just that trauma doesn't linger, right? Because we know that whenever violence runs rampant through communities, it also leaves those rippling effects. I mean, take a look at the homicide rate in Kansas City, Missouri, whereas 19 of the last homicides were domestic violence related. And I recognize that, being from Missouri myself and living across state line in Kansas now, I still have a lot of friends that live in Missouri, and they contact me like, "Did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this?" And it's just this ongoing epidemic that continues running rampant. And I know Kansas City had a very high rate of sexual violence and gun violence, and still does. But especially during the height of the pandemic, and then also like the after and those lingering effects too, I think that's incredibly important to recognize. And that after the postvention, we spend a lot of time focusing on prevention, and not that that's not obviously deeply important, because preventing before is obviously incredibly important to recognize, but also the after part and those lingering effects that violence has on survivors, I think that's deeply important to recognize too. So thank you for bringing awareness, both of those obviously, but also just everything that you do with SVPA. I think it's just deeply impactful, that something that our country was lacking for the longest time, and I'm glad it exists now, and we'll continue amplifying the work that you're doing, collaborate, and I'm deeply excited and honored to sit down and talk with you. It's been an absolute honor.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you letting me just kind of rant and talk about our work. But yeah, really appreciate all that y'all are doing, especially amplifying not just our work, but other really important orgs' work. We originally got connected to y'all through Survivors for Justice Reform, which is a great org doing work on abolition and just justice
Yes.
reform broadly. And that's how we originally got connected to y'all. And they do amazing work as well. And that's just like, one example of many of the orgs that you work with, where their work, as I said, any issue is every issue and any fight is every fight. And so it's always great for us to see the other work that you share, because sometimes it'll we'll be like, oh yeah, we should talk about that thing. And I'm hoping, we just spoke a little bit before that the podcast started about the fact that Intersex Awareness Week or Intersex Advocacy Week. I'm not sure what the name is. I'm intersex myself, so I should probably know. But Intersex Awareness Week is about to come up, and we're going to share a post. And I believe that you said you were going to joint post it with us as
Yes.
well. And I hope that that will jog other orgs, to cover, intersex issues and to talk about the intersection between people who are intersex and whatever they cover, right? So we're going to talk about how being intersex, results in a lot of intersex people undergo sexual violence, either state-sanctioned sexual violence, forced surgeries on children, but also sexual violence later in life. But I hope it jogs other people, whatever their issue is that they're right, that they're working on, whether it be economic inequality or housing disparities or things like that. Those are also things intersex people experience. So I'm hoping, I think that what you do is so great because it's an exchange of ideas amongst those in their respective movements, so that we are collectively a broader movement. And I think that's so important.
I agree. And I have to agree. This fight is everybody's fight, and there's definitely not enough people that's doing this work. That's for sure. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are hundreds of thousands of people that are doing this, but There's always space for hundreds of thousands, if not billions, of more people recognizing this ongoing epidemic that is so incredibly broad across marginalized communities and the most further oppressed communities. And yes, I think amplifying the work that you are doing in the intersex space, and then, I first met my first intersex peer of a person. Wow, I'm blanking on finding the words because this left me like very kind of like recognizing that everybody exists, right? And I'm not the most educated in intersex because I'm not intersex myself. However, I recognize that it is a further marginalized community within the LGBTQ plus community is oftentimes left out of the conversation, kind of like the two-spirit community. I think it's still, there's so many intersections and so many intersectionality here that I think is important to recognize as well. And but I went to a conference in Kansas City and I met my very first intersex person. And I sat down and I was just genuinely curious. I was like, is there any question that is not that you don't want me to ask? Because I'm genuinely curious and I'm really interested in learning about it. And I sat down and talked to her for at least like 3 hours, just learning everything there possibly is. And I became an advocate for intersex people because it's fucked up about the forced sterilization. And then also thinking about, oh God, that's a whole, you're gonna have to come on another podcast episode and educate about intersex violence because it's not talked about nearly enough at all. And I can't think off the top of my head. I know that there's like Interact, there's a couple other organizations, but other than that, it's very like sparse, you know?
Well, yeah, and everything is falling to those few orgs. Interact is like the big one, and everything is falling to them. Yeah, it's really a problem. And it's definitely, I think, being intersex myself, it's interesting that I do think it can be kind of overlooked in the community, in the broader like LGBTQ plus community. Of course, it's definitely overlooked in the broader community, like society, but by even by queer people, it's often overlooked, and the understanding of it isn't super clear. And I think it's hard. And this could be another podcast, and I'd be happy to talk about it, because I will say there's so many different ways to be intersex, right? It's people with hormones, chromosomes, physical anatomy, other reasons that they may have something that's not traditionally male or female, one of the two sexes, right? They have a combination. That's what intersex means, inherently. And oftentimes, like everybody else, we are force assigned a gender at birth, right? I was force assigned a gender at birth, and then I went through medical treatments I didn't actually go through any as a young child. I did as a teenager. But many do as well, right? These forced medical treatments, which are often include examinations and full-on surgeries, which cause complications later in life. They're not medically necessary, and they cause complications later in life and many issues. And that's, we feel, a form of sexual violence, and that should be acknowledged, that that's a form of sexual violence. Once again, right? You're touching a child without their consent, and changing their body without their consent. Not to bring up SORVO again too, but that's also SORVO. That's what they accuse trans people of doing, right? They say, oh, all you queer people are transing our children, and it's like, no, y'all are the ones forcing children to change their gender. Y'all are the ones forcefully, literally under force, changing their bodies medically unnecessarily when they are children. So I just think that, yeah, intersex people unfortunately have been overlooked quite a lot. And there's a lot of intersex people. A lot of people don't know they're intersex till later in life. That's very, very common. But intersex people are almost 2% of the population, about as common as redheads or identical twins. So think about how many redheads you know. Think about how many identical twins you know. That's how many intersex people there are. So you definitely know intersex people. Everybody knows intersex people. They might not know themselves, right? Some intersex people don't know, but in general, there are so many of us, and so many people who, have undergone these really invasive procedures and harms. Not to mention that people who are visibly intersex or visibly gender nonconforming experience sexual violence later in life as well due to homophobia and transphobia and all of those things. So yeah, definitely something that's overlooked, and I would be happy to talk about state-sanctioned sexual violence and how governments encourage this violence against intersex youth and intersex adults as well. But yeah, it's definitely something that I think needs to be focused on a little bit more. But Interact does some great work, and there's a few orgs out there really working hard on this issue, but I hope to see it adopted a little bit more by some of the bigger LGBTQ plus groups, to focus on intersex people more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredibly important. I think we can all recognize the ongoing need to, expand our knowledge and expand our advocacy to incorporate all, because if we're not incorporating all, we're not truly inclusive, and there's a lot of people that are still being left out of the conversation. And I appreciate you bringing awareness to it and bringing your own understanding and your own perspectives and your own story even. I think it absolutely needs to be amplified, and there's not enough conversation around it. There definitely is not. But again, I appreciate you coming on the podcast today, and I am so excited to continue collaborating with you, continue amplifying, and I'm in awe of everything that you do, everything you are. I embrace you, I see you, and I will continue amplifying your voice because I deeply believe in it.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me today. And thank you so much for just seeing us and amplifying our work even early on, right? Like, you have been so supportive of Sorvo before it was even published, for example. You've been very so supportive in amplifying our work. And then, as I mentioned before, amplifying so many other orgs, with the sharing of ideas, it's just so vital to have that and have this coordination amongst movements. It is so important. So I really appreciate all that you do, and I look forward to working together more.
Absolutely. Take it easy, my friend, okay?
All right, you too. Stay safe out there.
You as well. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.